You've probably noticed, if you've looked over the notes, that they're not changing much from week to week in this focus on the land's covenant. And part of that is because I thought that we would be going through the material faster than we actually did. And a good bit of that's simply because my mind tracks off into different directions. And I would like for us to focus this evening on the actual details that are involved in Deuteronomy 29 and 30. It's two chapters. And we've dealt with some of the stuff that started chapter 29, talking about how it was a different covenant than the Mosaic covenant at Sinai. The issues that are in the early part of chapter 29 are reminders about what happened to them when they were in the 40 years of wilderness wandering, and how their shoes didn't wear out and their clothes didn't wear out, and they had breakfast, dinner, and supper provided for them every day. And even when they were opposed in verse 7 and 8, Sihon and Og were the ones to first challenge them militarily, and God gave them victories both times. And you know from your annual reading through the whole Bible that there are many references, especially in the Psalms and some of those. They're constantly being pointed back to the deliverance from Egypt. It's a constant. It's like, I know you guys have heard this before, but I'm going to tell you again and again and again. But you have to keep in mind, too, that in the progress of Revelation, most of those exhortations to remember were for a different generation, the next following, whatever. So in verses 10 and following in chapter 29, Moses says, "You stand today, all of you, before the Lord your God, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, the alien who's within your camp, from the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, for this purpose," verse 12, "that you may enter into the covenant with the Lord our God." Now that's Yahweh, your Elohim. I don't know if you've been made aware, probably you have, but when the word Lord is printed in the English text, the letters are different sizes because it's a capital L and it's a big L, but the O and the R and the D are also capital letters. They're just half size. That's a dead giveaway that they're translating the name, the four-letter name of God, Yahweh, which is in Hebrews four consonants, but it's got some vowels assumed in there. So when you see L-O-R-D and it's all caps, even though the last three are smaller in size, that's Yahweh. And then the word God is almost always Elohim. That's the beginning in Genesis 1. In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. So this is specific because in the situation that they have been living and the land into which they're going are full of deities. And you all know the story of Elijah on Mount Carmel, where he just said, "How long do you stand between two opinions? Just make up your mind. If Baal's God, then serve him. But if Yahweh's God, then serve him." And the reason for that is because of the propensity that they had for just chasing off any kind of God and every kind of God they could think of. And even when Aaron threw that golden that just miraculously came into a golden calf, that's the dumbest story. But anyway, I could have thought of a better excuse than that. But the point is, they were just that far from idolatry every day. And it's amazing because of what Yahweh had done in their sight. I mean, that's why they're constantly referred back to the wilderness wanderings, because they had this pillar of fire in the day or at night and this pillar of cloud every day. And they had the manna every day, and they had specially provided water all the time. And it just went on and on and on. They were living on a miraculous level. Of no human group has ever lived at that level of miraculous provision for a whole 40-year generation. I mean, when Jesus was here, he was doing that kind of stuff, but he was only on the scene about 7 years. And the people that were there when he was here on the earth, they got to see this miraculous stuff on a regular basis if they were following him around. But every generation before that and after that is like ours. We don't see this kind of stuff. So they're going to enter into a covenant with Yahweh their Elohim. And they're going to go into His oath, which Yahweh your Elohim is making with you today, in order that He may establish you today as His people, that He may be your Elohim, just as He spoke to you and as He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, in verse 14, he begins to develop more. This covenant, he says, is not alone for you, but those who are here today, standing with us today in the presence of Yahweh our God, our Elohim, and those that are not with us here today. So there's this whole generational thing where this covenant is going to go on beyond this generation. He's making it with the people that are going to come after this generation. And then there's this parenthesis in verse 16 and 17 that refers back to how they lived in the land of Egypt and how they came through the midst of the nations and they've seen the abominations and their idols of wood, stone, silver, gold, which they had with them. And this covenant is being extended, lest there be among you a man or a woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turns away today from Yahweh our Elohim to go and serve the gods of those nations, lest there shall be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. Now you have to keep verse 4 in mind. Verse 4 says, yet to this day the Lord has not given you a heart, nor eyes to see or ears to hear, a heart to know. And so, even though he's told them that, he's still insisting that they commit themselves to this covenant. And he says that if you don't, well, then there are going to be these people that are poisonous fruit among you. They're going to drag the whole thing down. And that's always the case. Very seldom do you have a godly person that is pulling others up. It happens occasionally under the ministry of the Spirit and that kind of thing. But generally speaking, wickedness draws the righteous down. Seldom do the righteous draw the wicked up. Now, you know, we're supposed to be doing our witnessing for the Lord and evangelism, that kind of thing. And on occasion, somebody will actually believe what we're telling them and they'll be born in the family of God. But that'll be one out of however many. And so, even in all of the scriptures, Paul and Proverbs and all of them tell you that you have to be careful about your companions because they'll drag you down. So, it says in verse 20, well, I skip verse 19, that's a bad verse to skip because it says, it shall be when he hears the words of this curse, that is this root bearing poisonous fruit, he will boast and say, I have peace. Though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart in order to destroy the watered land with the dry. In other words, this is the unbeliever who says, I don't need God. I've got, my life's pleasant. I've got peace. But it says in verse 20, the Lord will never be willing to forgive him. But rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will burn against that man. And every curse which is written in this book will rest on him. And the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. That's a scary statement because it applies to anybody that says, I have peace though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. And goodness, doesn't that pretty much cover all of us at some point? I mean, didn't we all at some point in our lives bow our necks and say, I'm going to do what I want to do?
My version says, I will be safe even though I persist in going my own way.
Mm-hmm. So, I have this favorite little illustration. I've already shared it with you on at least one occasion. But in a lot of these things that God says, there's what I call an enormous amount of slop in the gears. And, you know, slop in the gears is a term they use back when the rear axle drive on all of these engines that are on all these vehicles that had rear wheel drive. They had a gear that ran this way, and they had a gear that ran this way, and they melded together so that the engine could feed a spin this way into this, they call it the pumpkin, but it would spin a gear this way, and this gear would have teeth beveled in such a way that a gear here, a bigger one, would be spun by this one. So as this one was going this way, this one was going this way, and the axles were driven, and that's why you got this right angle drive. But over time, and especially back before they had a lot of the alloys that are being used in all the metallurgy now, over time, those gears would get worn. And then there'd be, we just called it slopping the gears. But you could hear it whine, carry on. And they'd still work, but it made a lot of noise. And if you didn't do something over enough long enough time, they'd quit working. I mean, they'd break off or whatever. In a lot of the things that God says, there is a lot of tolerant patience and resistance even on God's part to actually apply these words in every case. And that's why those of us who have in the past been stiff-necked and stubborn don't have God saying, I'll never forgive that person. We have illustrations of it with the guy that went out and picked up firewood on the Sabbath right after the Sabbath was instituted as the sabbatical sign of the covenant. That guy went out there to pick up wood on the Sabbath, being told that you don't do that or you'll be executed. And he thought he'd get away with it. Well, they caught him and they took him to Moses and said, what do we do? And God said, kill him. But he obviously didn't kill everybody that didn't observe the Sabbath. There wouldn't have been anybody around. 490 years they ignored the Sabbath years. And the same thing was true with Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias lied about how much money he got for the sale of his property. Fell over dead. As soon as Peter confronted him. The young men carried him out and buried him without even telling his wife he was dead. She came in 3 hours later and Peter said, did you get X number of dollars for the sale of your property? Yep, that's what we got. Bang, she fell over dead. And they carried her out and buried her beside her lying husband. But what if God killed everybody that lied? We'd all be dead. That's what I'm saying. There's a lot of grace in a lot of these warnings. It's grace because we certainly don't deserve to be let off the hook, but by and large, we are in a lot of ways. So was the nation for a season. Now, it says the Lord will single him out. In verse 21, from all the tribes of Israel, according to all the curses of the covenant, which are written in the book of the law. So this generation to come, your sons who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues on the land and the diseases which the Lord has afflicted, it will say, all the land's brimstone and salt, a burning waste, thrown and unsown and unproductive. No grass grows there. And all the nations in verse 24 say, why? Why has the Lord done this to this land? And the men will say, because they forsook the covenant. And though there is a lot of slop in the gears, you better never count on it. Because that is, just adds stubbornness to stubbornness. That's almost like saying, see, I did get away with it. So, point is, all the way down through here, there are these warnings, and there are these things that are told to them, and it even says in verse 26, they went out and served other gods and worshipped them, and their God had not allotted those gods to them, so the anger of Yahweh burned against that land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. And you remember that when they entered into the land, they had several tribes on this mountain calling out the blessings, and they had a bunch of tribes on this mountain calling out the curses. Well, that was a warning to them as they were going to the land that they needed to observe the covenant so that they could be under the blessing. And though God was very patient, long-suffering for 1,500 years, the time came in 70 A.D. when God removed them from the land with a terrible destruction. Josephus calls it the worst thing that had ever happened on the planet. Of course, Josephus was a Jew, and that's the way he viewed it. But the point is, God didn't reverse that until 1948, and the Holocaust and all of the stuff that the Jews have suffered in that interim period was because they had forsaken the covenant. and the rejection of their own Christ by murder in the first century, God didn't let that go but about 35 years before the nation was ruined and they were dispersed throughout all the nation.
Where they lived, it went back to being desert and barren, and nothing grew there. So when they came back to it in the 1940s, they had to build it back.
Yeah.
And they had to recultivate it to make it what it is now.
Yeah. And even now, they're not operating in faith. They're in the prelude stages. Well, we always have. The gospel is out to every nation, and Israel's one of the nations it goes to. And there are people from every kindred, nation, tongue, and tribe that are going to respond to the gospel, and that includes some that are Jewish. But the nation itself is in that Ezekiel dry bones period, where the bones are being pulled together and the sinews are being built upon the bones. That's a metaphor of God reestablishing the nation in the land. And it's in here. It says in verse 28, the Lord Yahweh uprooted them from their land. And then chapter 30, it says it'll be when all these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I've set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations where the Lord, where Yahweh your God has banished you. See, that's a prophecy that is going to be this way. And it took a couple of millennia for it to develop, but it developed. You went from the entrance in the land, which was in the 1500 BC approximately, and they were finally dispersed in 70 AD. So you had somewhere around 1600 years where this kingdom, this nation, was functioning with some loyalty and a great lot of disloyalty. And, you know, you've read the Kings and the Chronicles and all that. But the long-term result was they finally pushed the tolerance and patience of God to its limit, and He dispersed them. And basically, they've been treated as an orphan child ever since. But God didn't give up on the promise, because He says in verse 2, you're going to return to Yahweh your God and obey Him with all your heart and soul according to all that I command you today. And then the Lord will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you. And you'll gather again all the peoples that the Lord your God has scattered you from. He's going to gather them all back. All your outcasts that are at the ends of the earth, from there the Yahweh your God will gather you. And from there He'll bring you back. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it, and He'll prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. And then you have in verse 6 of chapter 30 the new covenant promise. Moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all, in order that you may live. So the Lord's going to, verse 7, inflict all these curses on the enemies after the return, and you will again obey the Lord. So even in this covenant, one of the things that stands out is God is giving them the land as a permanent ownership issue, but He is using their inability to profit from the produce of the land as a disciplinary action. Before the Assyrian captivity, God sent invaders into the land, and they took the produce of the fields and stuff when they subjected the nation, and then they'd cry out for a deliverer, and God would raise up a judge, and He'd deliver them for maybe a generation, and they'd get to use the land again. But as soon as they turned away from the Lord, same kind of disciplinary action. Well, it finally got to the point at the Assyrian captivity in 722, where it wasn't going to be invaders coming in and taking all their food and stuff and letting them stay there. God said, no, they're going to be dispersed. They're going to be out of the land. And so Assyria did that to the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom in 722, and Nebuchadnezzar started the process in 605 BC with the Babylonian captivity, and it was it lasted 70 years, one full generation. And then he let them go back into the land, summoned them back to the land. But even though there's no record after that they were idolatrous. They didn't set up their Asherim and their false gods and all that kind of stuff. But their worship became only outward. They'd use the name Yahweh our God, but they didn't care anything about walking with him or being obedient to him or any of that. They just give lip service to it. And that was Isaiah's burden. That was Jeremiah's burden. That was Malachi's burden. The last prophet was still on their case about the foolishness of their rebellion against their God. But it's all because, in the final analysis, it's all because their hearts were not circumcised. And that, of course, is a big promise of the New Covenant. It's a promise that we get to participate in, even though we're not going to inherit any land, per se. Our inheritance is the New Jerusalem. The church is not promised a national land, a geographic area, even though there are a lot of people that seem to think America is the, the new promised land. It never was and never is and is never going to be. Because the church is focused not on the outer man, and it's not focused on lip service to God. Genuine believers in the new covenant in the church worship God from the heart, in spirit and in truth. And this is the relational era of human beings with God. And so our bodies are given over to what they're given over to. That's why we're, you know, suffering all the stuff we suffer, because God has said, look, it's not about your physical well-being. It's about your relationship with me. But Israel didn't learn that because they were all focused on the outer man. Go ahead.
Do you think these many returns that the Bible does record, do you think those are near-term fulfillment of the prophecy and the far-term fulfillment of the prophecy still out there for the thousand years? Rain?
Well, the final regathering is going to happen during the 70th week of Daniel. We call it the Great Tribulation or the Tribulation. It's a seven-year period that's going to follow the church age. But the very fact that God has brought the Israel into their land and kept them there since 1948 in spite of all of the opposition of the whole world and the demons and everybody else, even though they're not believing, he has brought them back to the land, and there is no indication that they'll ever leave it again. He's going to take them from what we're seeing right now. He's going to take them from this into the tribulation, the 70th week of Daniel.
But in the return of the land, they have never taken full possession?
No, they haven't ever gotten what they've been promised, but they have been reestablished as a nation. So that's one of the reasons. You sent that text this morning about the prayer around the world for revival. I'm so skeptical of that because I don't see a revival happening. I see the tribulation coming. I mean, I'm not opposed to praying for God to revive his work in the midst of the years and that kind of thing, but I don't see it happening. I see.
I pray for a lot of stuff. I don't
expect it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's almost like we're being refined.
We are.
Believers who are becoming more of a true believer than they ever were. But then you also have those who are just so completely blind that they'll never see him.
Right.
No matter what you do.
Yeah, we're living in the age that would be called Laodicean, lukewarm. The vast majority of people who give lip service to being a believer in Jesus are too wrapped up in their own little physical, materialistic stuff. And as a consequence, their need for God only comes when they get in desperate situation, and that's usually where he brings them out of their lukewarmness into some vital, real relationship. And of course, it's a hard price to pay, but it's really worth it. I mean, if we have to get dragged through the mud in order to get our eyes open, then drag us through the mud. Because it'll be a far better thing to understand and then start walking with God in the light. Whatever it costs.